Anyway, we're not here to talk about the vagaries of trans-Tasman politics. What we are here today is to talk about configuring and deploying just enough and just in time administration. But we'll also go through some of the new security ideas or the new security thinking that's going into these technologies and how Microsoft wants you to start thinking about on-prem security and to an extent in the cloud security going forward, because they want there to be a sea change. You know, if you've been in one of my sessions before, and you'll see it again when I do a session in this room on Friday, I'll talk about all the mistakes that we make where people leave, you know, every account in the domain admins group sort of a thing. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about security. We're going to talk about ways that we can remediate ourselves and that the technologies that are coming and the philosophies behind those technologies that are going to sort of really inform how we think about doing security in the future. So in this session, we're going to talk about sort of four general points. The first is that we have met the enemy and it is us. And that's that thing I keep telling you and I keep presenting here and at conferences around the world, that the biggest problems in security is often bad configuration mistakes or simply overprivileging yourself. And that causes a lot more problems than external hackers does. Because external hackers get in, but if your security's poorly configured, that's always going to be a bit of a problem. We'll talk about the assume breach mentality, we'll talk about just-in-time administration, and I'll do a demo, and then we'll talk about just-enough administration. So, if you've been to my sessions, you know that I talk about this a lot. I talk about this idea that we're so focused on getting things to just work that we spend little time ensuring that it works in a secure manner. And that's not just IT pros, that's developers as well. And developers, in fact, perhaps more so, because they often don't necessarily think about the security ramifications of the decisions that they make. So we are expected to do a lot more with a lot less. We often put things into development and we make a whole lot of shortcuts when we're doing it in a development environment that becomes a production environment unintentionally. And then we've got all of these things that are going on where we've made security shortcuts where we know we haven't done the right thing, but we didn't think that we were making it secure from the beginning. And that's sort of a mentality that we need to change. That even in development environments, we need to build our dev environments so that just out of practice, we're doing them in a secure way. We also know that a lot of IT security involves closing barn doors after horses have bolted. That we go and approach something or that we only get the resources to go and deal with a problem after the problem has occurred or after it's happened and it's been so blindingly obvious that someone turns around and says, right, we're going to do something about that. It's sort of like me and my Telstra bill. I pay my Telstra bill after I get the warning from Telstra saying, please go and pay your Telstra bill. Not when the thing arrives in the envelope, you know, that's just a kind of a reminder. So it's a bit like that in terms of IT security and closing the barn doors after the horse has bolted. Now, one of the things that Microsoft's obviously been doing eternally is thinking about security. We know back 15 years ago that Microsoft's reputation around security was not good. You had people like Steve Riley who would come out and speak at this conference and who would tell you about all of the things that they were thinking of. Well, they have been constantly thinking about it. And they've been thinking, how do we deal with not only the threats that existed back then, but the adaption? Because what happens is, of course, if you improve security, if you make a better bank, you get a better bank robber. If you make a better mousetrap, you end up with a smarter mouse. With security, we need to rethink the way that we do systems administration to make that level, again, more difficult for the people that are trying to attack our systems or, in our own case, people inside the organisation, people outside the organisation. Very important and very understood now is that a large number of attacks involves insiders. So we've got Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden worked for Bose Allen Hamilton and basically went through the NSA network by spidering stuff, by stuff he had access to. Now, he was able to get access to other people's administrator accounts and use those to leverage, but he was able to get that big trove of data and then go off to where he ended up in Moscow with all of that data because he was an insider. You've got Bradley Chelsea Manning, okay, was a low-level IT support person who was able to basically surf file shares and pull secure data, put it on a CD-ROM, label a CD-ROM Lady Gaga, and walk out of the base, and then basically eventually hand it over to Julian Assange, indirectly, allegedly. We have the Ashley Madison breach, which looks like it came from an insider who was just upset at the whole philosophy of Ashley Madison, and who pulled the database and then moved it out. So one of the things that we're seeing is an awareness among the greater community that perhaps the most dangerous people in terms of security are IT, are people that already have that access. So that, yes, we like to, you know, we see this very much, certainly in the political discussion that's going on in the moment, at the moment around the hacks of a particular political party's web servers and mail servers, whether or not these were actually internal. It's great to go and point at an external enemy and say, oh, it's these external guys, they're the ones that have gone and hacked us. Because that's really good. It's much worse when it's someone who's inside your organisation who's been the cause of that, because that suggests that the lapse has been somewhere else. A substantial number of attacks involve the use of insider credentials. And this, when we're talking about just enough administration and just-in-time administration, is the key. Because what we're going to do is we're going to come up with a way of making insider credentials almost useless at a certain point in time, so that even if someone gets them, they can't do anything with them. So you look at the Target breach. What happened in the Target breach is that you had someone who got access to basically the air conditioning vendor's VPN account, and they used that to get in to the system that did the operating system deployment for all of the registers at Target. And what they did is they infected the operating system deployment image so that the registers were being deployed every day and they were being deployed with malware on them. So that then the malware was scraping the credentials of credit cards, it was coming to a centralised server and then being uploaded to somewhere in Eastern Europe. And they got a lot of credit cards that way. Email Metals was a company I worked for. And in that case, what happened was we had a member of staff who was senior to everybody, and he thought, well, seeing he was senior and seeing he was in charge of the systems administrators, no, he was in charge of the manager of the person of the who was managing the systems administrators, that he should have the same permissions as those people, because in his mind it logically followed that if he could order his subordinate to order a systems administrator to do something, why couldn't he have those permissions directly? And what ended up happening, and this was quite, this is back in the NT4 days, what ended up happening was he logged his teenage son onto computers on a Saturday morning when he was in at the office that the IT staff used, using his own account. And his own account was really privileged, and his son decided to have fun renaming every account in User Manager for Domains with the most creative expletives he could come up with. So we arrived at work on Monday and every account looked like basically what you'd expect if you gave a caffeinated 13-year-old a dictionary of swear words. That's, you know, not necessarily... Fired administrators. Administrators who get fired, you will see in the news, often come back after they've been fired and then are able to log onto the network and then go and delete some databases. So these are people who have permissions, but their permissions haven't been revoked when they leave the organisation. We'll talk a little bit more about those sort of things on when we do our session on Friday. Now, one of the great big statements that the head of the NSA made at a security conference was, it's much easier for us to compromise an administrator than it is for us to compromise the systems that the administrator manages. If we can get an admin's credentials, we can get access to their systems. So what we need to do, and one of the big changes in the way that we're thinking about things with just-in-time administration and just-enough administration, is even if an attacker has an administrator's credentials, their username and their password, we can minimise the amount of damage that can be done. So we're going to change, we're going to flip that so that even if they've got administrator and password, that doesn't necessarily mean that they can actually do anything with it, because we're going to set the system up so that we're not working that way. Even if they've got their user account credentials, there's going to be other things in place that are actually going to stop that from happening. So I want you to think about this, and this is what you should always think about in security. How would you stop an evil version of yourself from attacking your network? In some cases, people would say, well, I'm so brilliant that there's no way I could stop an evil mirror universe version of myself. Or, you know, the evil mirror universe version of myself would probably be on my sofa and watching the wrong sort of television. You're probably keeping up with the Kardashians or something like that. But think about security in this way. How do you stop yourself? How would you stop yourself? Don't think about someone on the other side of the firewall. Think about someone as clever as you, because obviously you're all quite brilliant people. You know, when you're doing evaluations, remember when the speaker compliments you, that's worth more points. This isn't really one of the more funny sessions. The other funny session's on Friday, but, you know, I can't stop myself when it comes to the occasional joke. Always assume, okay, so mirror universe version of you, or just assume that your attacker is smarter. What would if someone's smarter than you? And it's very hard to sort of get your mindset into the idea that smarter, but always think as your opposition is smarter, even though that you know that when you walk out in the world and you encounter people, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of them that are smarter than you. Just pretend that out there is some evil genius who wants to get into your university department file server or whatever you manage. So when properly prepared, the less intelligent can block the plans and the actions of the more intelligent. And you only have to think about your own life to think about how many times you've been stymied by a dumb person, okay? Dumb people who prepare can stop smart people who prepare. It's just a matter of figuring out what you do. So again, there is a way that you can build up a structure that you can protect. You're never going to have perfect security. This is just another step towards tighter security. Because what you don't want to be is you don't want to be the person in the meeting explaining after the post-breach all of the steps that you could have taken but didn't. I mean, you could explain those steps as long as you've got documentation saying, we really should do this. And if management says no, well, you've got the documentation that you at least tried. So, administrator accounts are often overprivileged. And who here has ever complained that they've been given privileges that they don't need? Oh, okay. Yeah. Most of us are sort of privileged pack rats. It's like, okay, I don't think I need to administer the Exchange server, but if you're giving me the rights, well, maybe one day that will be really useful. Administrators also have an attitude, often, because they've worked with users, that perhaps they're the only ones that can be trusted with the keys to the kingdom. That perhaps delegating out administrative abilities or administrative duties is difficult. We have this discussion sometimes when we're talking about whether or not HR should be able to provision users. Does it make sense for IT to actually reset a user password, or should HR do it? Because there's arguments that HR should do it, because HR is actually able to ask questions that make sense of the person who needs their password reset. And it's a lot harder to social engineer HR than IT, because HR has a lot more information. It's like, okay, what's your home address? You want your password reset? Tell me your home address. Now, IT doesn't know that. HR probably does. So the assume breach philosophy is that we should assume that an attacker has already penetrated our system, that the malware is already on our system, that the Trojans are already there. And how do we protect ourselves if they're already inside the network? Because as many security researchers say, if you're absolutely certain that there's no one inside your network, you're delusional. I mean, it might not be that they're there, but you should assume that they're there. So how do we stop them when they're there? How do we limit the damage? And this is this new model of just in time and just enough administration, because we're moving away from this model where you've got basically a Superman account or a Superwoman account, which is an account that has permissions over every machine in the organisation. We'll move away from that to endpoints that have permissions on specific machines, where the permissions to get to that endpoint are time-based. So rather than having an account that just basically is a master key where you can unlock something, you've got a requester key, and then you can do something for a couple of minutes on a very specific machine. And then once that expires, it doesn't matter if someone's got your credentials, because they can't do anything without that permissions framework that exists around the account to privilege that account at that time. So think of it, if you know the superhero Green Lantern only has powers when he's wearing his Green Lantern ring, right? Think of it as the Green Lantern ring being in a box, and the powers or the wishes that that Green Lantern ring can make can only be used, a very specific set of wishes, at a very specific point in time. So the idea with assumed breach and the idea behind just enough administration and just in time administration is that we get away from this, I've got this account that can do anything I want, anywhere I want, anytime I want, to I've got this account that can request the ability to do a very limited set of things at a very specific time. And that's the change in thinking that we're moving towards. So, the current approach is to shore up the castle defences. And of course, a strong castle defence is very important. But a great castle design allows defenders to continue to defend the castle once the enemy is inside the gates. This is what assumed breach is about. You assume that the bad guys have got over the fence, right? It's like in, you know, without wanting to use Lord of the Rings in a New Zealand room, it's like Lord of the Rings, okay? When the orcs get over the fence, you can still defend the castle. You can still defend it. You don't have to wait for Gandalf to come over the hill on his horse, right? Your castle it's like Onion's donkey, you know, to quote Shrek. Instead of like ogres, it's just like your defences. Design for resiliency. One proton torpedo should never, ever, ever take out the Death Star. Okay? The Death Star should not have been, you know, I know that we've got a whole movie coming up explaining the whole thing. And maybe there was a reason that that exhaust port just below the main port was vulnerable to that particular attack, but it shouldn't be. That there shouldn't be that sort of thing. It should be, okay, we've been hit, but we'll still keep going. It should be like the Enterprise in the most recent Star Trek movie, which really held up, even though it got really chewed through and eventually got destroyed, but it took it a lot to destroy the Enterprise. One vulnerability should not allow everything on the network to be pwned. And that big vulnerability has traditionally been administrator accounts. You get the administrator accounts, you own the network. So, just in time and just enough administration are about limiting what accounts can do and where they can do it. So, first thing we're going to talk about is just in time administration. Just in time administration requires Microsoft Identity Manager. There's a whole architecture and I'll go through it. So Microsoft Identity Manager itself requires SQL Server 2012 SP1 or later, SharePoint Foundation 2013, and with SP1 of Microsoft Identity Manager 2016, it's now supported with SharePoint 2016. Windows Server 2012 R2 or with Service Pack 1, you can also use Windows Server 2016. The slides, of course, will be available online. So if you want to take photos, that's great, but you can also get this all online. And we are being streamed on Channel 9. So just-in-time administration, another name for this is privileged access management. So privileged access management is what you actually call it when you're using the technology, but just-in-time administration is sort of the headline name for it. Delegated privileges only work for a limited amount of time. So the way that this works at a really high level is you have your production forest. And in your production forest, you have normal user accounts. You have no privileged accounts. You have privileged groups, but the group membership, there is no group membership there. What you then have is you have a separate administrator forest. Now, the administrative forest is trusted by the production forest. And there are shadow groups. So Microsoft Identity Manager allows synchronization of groups. So you can create, basically using SID history and a whole lot of hokey pokey, you can create it so that the membership of a group in the administrative forest mirrors the membership of a group in the production forest. So when someone requests elevation using their normal account, a shadow version of that account in the administrative forest is added on a time-limited basis to a shadow group, which, through the magic of SID history, gives them membership of a group in the local forest. So the way it works is, and I'll show you this, you have an account in the other forest that is unprivileged in its forest that can be made privileged in your local forest for a limited amount of time. So you say, I want to be a member of this privileged group. It can be approved, or it might not be approved, but you can set up an approval framework, you can set up an automatic approval framework. And then for the next 60 minutes, by default, you're a member of that group. So you log in with that account in the other forest, you can do stuff. Now, of course, the account in the other forest is unprivileged there. It's only privileged for a certain amount of time in the local forest. So what you're doing is you're using these two different forests where you've got your clean administrative accounts here, and no one in this forest has administrative access to this forest. So that even if an account here gets compromised, it's not compromised in this other forest. It'll make, I guess, more sense as we go through it. So the idea is that the user is booted from the group after an expiration date, and you update your ticket lifecycle so that after a certain amount of time, a new ticket needs to be requested and that new group membership takes effect, so that when someone tries to use membership of that group, it checks. Are you still a member of that group? No, you're not. Okay, you'll need to go back and request permission to be a member of that group to perform that particular task. So it uses multiple forests. In your admin forest, you have Microsoft Identity Manager. So setting it up, you use several new PowerShell commandlets. You create a new group in the account forest with the same SID as a group in the resource forest. Your resource forest is your production forest. Your account forest is your privilege forest. And as an object in Microsoft Identity Manager, and Microsoft Identity Manager handles all of the talking between these accounts. So sort of think of it as shadow accounts that exist. So that means that a person's shadow account in the admin forest has the same password as their account in the local forest. But their local, so you as an admin would be just logging on as your local user account. And then you say, I want to be elevated. You request elevation. And then you log on with the same account credentials, but with a different domain name using your trusted administrative forest. And then suddenly you're a member of a privileged group for a certain amount of time. You do your thing. You sign out, and then you're back in with your normal account. So commandlets need to be run once for each group and then once for each member of the group. And I'll show you all of this in a demonstration. So you can see that there's a bunch of PowerShell, and there's a document that'll actually go through all of the things that you need to do to set this up. And basically what you do is you install the forest, you create a trust relationship, and it's a one-way trust relationship. So the resource forest trusts the privileged forest, but an account in this resource forest can never go and manage the administrative forest, and you don't let anybody log on to the administrative forest directly. You only allow them to log on here. So again, you've got much more pristine accounts, because what you don't want to do is you don't want to have someone sort of, you know, a common attack is someone gets added to a member of the domain admins group. What's the thing that they do next? They go and add another account to the member of the domain admins group so that they've always got a fallback position. Well, it doesn't work that way. You can set Microsoft Identity Manager up so that someone can log onto a website and actually request access. So they literally go on and they say, I want access to this particular role. And they'll understand what the role does. Now, what we will do in the second part of this talk is that I'll actually go through and set up a role in Just Enough administration, and you'll see that what you can do is you can set up a role so that only certain PowerShell commandlets can be used with certain parameters and certain parameter values. So you can lock it down to the point where someone can only use, say, three PowerShell commandlets in a session. so that only for 60 minutes they can use these three administrative PowerShell commandlets to do something administrative. That's how the degree to which you can lock it down. So when someone requests access, they provide a reason, it's all logged, if you want to set it up this way. The way I'll do it in the demonstration is I'll do it all through PowerShell, because to use just enough administration, you've got to do it with PowerShell as well, and I want to show you how these two sort of interact with one another. A record is also kept in Microsoft Identity Manager of each elevation request. So this is the other part of locking down administration, is having an audit trail. Because then what you're doing is you're saying, okay, every time someone wanted to use a privileged account, they had it logged. And that's probably a lot better than I've seen some organisations that literally when someone logs on with a privileged account, it starts a screen recording and it screen records all of their activity. And they have, you know, gigabytes and terabytes of video logs of every administrative session that's done in that organisation. I've seen it done with a bank. Did it that way. So whenever anybody was doing anything administrative, there was a complete screen record of it. You can modify the properties of a secure group, such as to turn off. You can see here it's got the maximum TTL in seconds. So you can make it so that, for example, 180 seconds, that there's only 3 minutes. That's probably way too small. You might want to do it usually for something like an hour or half an hour, so the person can be a member of that group for half an hour, they get to do what they need to do, and then they lose those privileges. If they go need to do something more, they go and do that. And you figure out what makes sense for your organisation. Obviously, extremely sensitive tasks, you reduce the time frame. Less sensitive tasks, you give them a bit longer, because, you know, if they're constantly changing user passwords, you know, every 5 minutes, then you don't want to be basically making them re-authenticate every 10 minutes sort of to do it. So what I'll do now is I'll do a demonstration. And I'm using here my beautiful Lenovo P50. And my P50, just before I get into that, let me show you how much RAM this thing's got. Anybody see how much RAM? Too much, yes. And it's got a Xeon processor as well, so it's a really nice little, not so little, data center in a box. Okay, so here we are on Mel Server 1. And what we'll do is we're going to sign in as a user named Wayne. Now, Wayne is going to be our stand-in for our normal admin. So it's Wayne, and we put in Wayne's password. Okay, so the first thing I want to show you is I want to show you that Wayne has no privileges. So if I come in here and I do a Who Am I groups, and for those of you that are wondering, I'm using my Razer gaming device with all of my commands put in so I don't fat finger it. Very good way of getting things done. We can see in that list of groups that Wayne is not a member of any administrator groups. And what I've done is rather than, because I want Wayne to, so the scenario here is that Wayne wants to install WINS on this server. And to do that, Wayne needs local administrator privileges to install a role like that. So what I've done is I've created a group called Corp Admins. And Corp Admins is a member of the local administrator group on this particular computer. And through the process of elevation through just-in-time administration, I'm going to allow Wayne to become a member of that group by requesting membership of that group and then allowing him to install the role. But what I'm showing you straight off the bat here is that Wayne's not a member of any group. So if I go and try and install WINS server, and I use WINS because I love the fact that even in Server 2016, WINS is still there. I think if you want any sort of job security in Microsoft, you would go and work on the WINS team. Because this role never seems to ever want to die. So we go WINS server. And if I want to try and install that here, I click Add Features, and go Next, and I go Install. And what it'll do is it'll come back and it'll try to install it, and then it'll say, you do not have adequate user rights to make changes to the target computer. Of course, because Wayne is not elevated. He's not a member of any group. So let's close that and let's sign out. So when Wayne wants to do privilege stuff, what he can do is he can sign in as priv.wayne. So control alt end to get in, I go in other user, and then a datum admin, which is our trusted forest, priv.wayne. And I put in his password. Now, at the moment, this is the user that's in the other forest, but even though he's the user in the other forest, if we do a who am I slash groups, what we'll find is that this user also is not a member of the local administrator group and is not a member of the corp admins group, which is my group that's a member of the group. So this user doesn't have the ability to go and install Wins either, and I'll just demonstrate that. So go through, next, 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 scroll down, Wins server, add features, next, install, and the install fails because privileges aren't there. So we'll close that. So we'll come back to PowerShell. So what we're going to do now is that we're signed in as priv.wayne. And what we're going to do is we're going to request elevation. And the way that we do that is we first bring in the PAM module for PowerShell, and then we'll see what PAM roles are available for this user to request. So when you're setting up just in-time administration, what you do is you say, this user can request these roles. And you can see that in PowerShell when you do it like this. So we pull in the module, which is mimpam. It'll load that module, and you install that on, you'd push that out to all of your computers because that's a new PowerShell module that's not included by default. It comes with Microsoft Identity Manager. And the next one is get PAM role for request. So if we run that one, what it'll do here is it'll say, we have the corp admin's role available. Here's the GUID of the corp admin's role, and here's the time to live of the corp admin's role. So we can see there that the corp admin's role is available to Wayne, that Wayne can use it for an hour, and that's the GUID of the role. So what we can do is, basically because we need that GUID, what we can do is we can come up with a PowerShell commandlet that will actually write to a variable called R, get PAM role for request, and all it's doing here is it's querying that role and it's getting the information about the corp admin's role and getting that GUID and putting it into that variable string R. Then new PAM request role and string R is the name of that role. So I hit enter there, and what it's doing is it's going off to the MIM server and it's saying I would like priv.wayne to be installed in that particular role. And so we get that set to a status of processing. So the easiest way to update our ticket is now to sign out, sign back in, sign in as priv.wayne, put in his password. We're back in, we've got Server Manager up. We will do a who am I groups. And when we do that, what we see is that Wayne has now been added to a datum corp admins. So we've automatically been added to a group. For the next 60 minutes, Wayne will be a member of that group, and that group then allows us to go and with Server Manager, install Wins. So that's a very basic demonstration of how just in time or administration or privileged access management works. You request the role, you're elevated in a way for a certain amount of time, and then you lose that elevation. So that's the first part of the puzzle, and you can see that the Wins server is installed there. So what I'll do is I'll just quickly just shut all of these off because I actually then need to spin up some other ones for the next demo. Pop. Yes, there is. So the question was, is there overheads in terms of New Forest? So Microsoft's sort of official guidance going forward with Server 2016 is that organisations should move towards having all of their admin accounts in what's called an ESAE or a privileged forest, so that you want to move away from having your privileged accounts in your resource forest. And the reason is that is that you can have what's called a secure source. And a secure source is that you know that your resource forest is going to be not able to be... Basically, the people that can administrate this forest aren't the people that can administrate this forest. And that you have very strict controls on the way that this... You'd run them all in shielded VMs. You'd basically have them only logging on with the machines that have got credential guard. You would use this as absolutely your lockbox forest for your administrative accounts. And so, yes, there's a lot of work here, but that's actually probably the easiest way to do it, because you can take your existing forest and configure that trust relationship without rebuilding your existing forest. What you're eventually doing is you're just migrating your admin accounts out of this resource forest and moving it across to the privileged forest. Question? Yes, so you can actually go with privileged access management, and any existing group you can make function in that way. So that's not a problem. So what I'll do there is I'll just minimise that and I'll get back to my slides. But yes, this is going to work with your existing infrastructure. Your big thing is that you basically need to go and put in a privileged forest. And that privileged forest only needs to be like two servers. It needs to be, well, no, three. You'd have two domain controllers, one for redundancy, and then you'd have your Microsoft Identity Manager server. And you could also do this, and eventually I'm quite sure that they'll allow you to do it with Azure AD, and you'll use Azure AD as your privileged forest. And they'll offer that just as a service to integrate it with your on-prem AD. But at the moment I'm talking about a specific on-prem solution. So what we'll do is we'll come back here, and now we'll talk about just enough administration. So there's a guide, aka.ms/pam, will actually give you all the walkthrough that you need to do to play around with that in your own lab. Now, just enough administration. The idea with just enough administration is I did something very traditional there. I added a group to the local administrators group that gave local administrators permissions. What you can do with just enough administration is you can create a PowerShell endpoint where only certain PowerShell commands can be used, with only certain parameters and certain values for those parameters. For example, you can set up a just enough administration endpoint that allows someone to restart the DNS service, but not restart any other service. So they connect, the only PowerShell command they've got is restart service, and if they use restart service for anything other than DNS, it's not going to work. The other interesting thing with just enough administration is that one, all activities logged. You configure endpoints so that only members of certain groups can connect. So you might say that the Corp Admins group are the only ones that can connect to this endpoint, or the DNS Ops group are the only ones that connect to a DNS Ops endpoint. Now, the other interesting thing is that when you're connected to the endpoint, a special virtual account is used. So what this means is that you can have an unprivileged account. Let's say the account user, and the one I'm going to use in my demo, is called Beth. Beth is a member of no special groups other than one called DNS Ops. And DNS Ops has no rights assigned to it whatsoever. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to create an endpoint that only allows people to connect who are members of the DNS Ops group to connect to that DNS Ops endpoint. Now, when she connects to that DNS Ops endpoint, she's not logged on as Beth. She's logged on as a local virtual account that has local administrator permissions. And before you go, oh my gosh, she's got local administrator permissions, remember that just enough administration limits you to specific commandlets. So yes, she's a local administrator, but she can only use specific commandlets and specific parameters. So if she can log on, and with the example I gave you before, she can restart the DNS service, and that's it. So none of her credentials are stored locally. So if someone attacks that machine and runs Mimikatz on it, they're not going to find best credentials there at all. So the idea is that rather than giving people privileged domain administrator accounts, what we do is we set up all of these endpoints that people connect to, they perform their tasks, and they perform only the tasks that we've prescribed to them, and then they disconnect from the endpoint. Their accounts are not credentialed other than when they're using the endpoint. And then, of course, you can go further with just-in-time administration and make it so that they can only connect to the endpoint because the membership of a group is required there for a certain amount of time. So that's how we lock it down completely. We say, right, you can only use these commandlets, and you're just no special group membership. You request group membership, you get it for 60 minutes, you can connect to an endpoint, you can use these commandlets with these parameters against these values, nothing else. You can do that, and then you finished your job. So that's the degree to which you can lock it down. It requires PowerShell 5 and WMF 5, works with Server 2012 R2 and Server 2016. So many of you aren't going to be in a space at the moment where you can deploy this. And this is understood. Part of what this session is about is saying this is where we're going. This is where Microsoft security is going. What Microsoft eventually wants is no one logging on with a privileged account. Because the moment you give someone admin access to a box, it makes it easier to compromise. Okay, so they log on to their Windows 10 machine, they open a browser, malware comes in through the browser, that malware basically runs a script that pulls Mimikatz, pulls their credentials, and then starts firing them across the network to see what access it gets. They want to avoid that sort of attack, because that sort of attack is extremely effective at the moment and really, really difficult to defend against. So they've gone to the stage where they've said, right, this is how we're going to build a structure to protect us from that sort of attack. So the old model where you had a domain administrator that could do everything in the organisation, yes, it's really useful and yes, it's easy to use, but no, it's not something that's inherently secure. So the biggest challenge with Just Enough Administrator is simply determining which PowerShell commandlets, values and parameters you need. Now, one of the other really cool things about the way that new Microsoft is doing things is that they're putting all of this up on GitHub. So people are literally saying, oh, by the way, if you need someone to do this role, this is all of the PowerShell commandlets and values and things. So you can basically just import this stuff for free off the internet. So people have already gone out and built a lot of this stuff. And because everybody's been collaborative under new Microsoft, they're sharing it. So there's basically, you can go into the gallery and you can pull this stuff and you can apply all of these configurations through desired state configuration so that your servers are automatically built with it rather than you doing what I'm going to show you in the demo. So what you have is, and I'll explain this also when I go through the demo, so you'll see it twice. You have what's called a role capability file. A role capability file is the file that says, this is what you can do. Then you have a session config file. And what the session config file says, this is the group that is mapped to the role capability file. So this is the group that they've got to be a member of. This is what they can do. You then go and create a session using it. So what we'll do is I'll show you how it works in terms of locking down access to a Windows role. So what I'm going to do, as I said, I'm going to create a user named Beth. Now, I've got a user named Beth. And what Beth's going to do is her job is going to be to basically look after DNS. And all she needs to do in DNS is create records and view the zone. So all Beth's role is she's going to create new A records in DNS. So the way that we're going to do that is we're going to start off, and I've logged onto a domain controller to do this with an administrator account, so you know. Of course, when you set this up, you need all of the power and then basically you have to relinquish it at some point. So I open up a PowerShell session, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a file under the modules directory for PowerShell called DNSOps, and then I'm going to build a module to do this. So I'll create the DNSOps directory, I'll create a new module manifest for this module, I'll create a role capabilities directory, and then what I'll do is I'll create a role capability file, and then we're going to edit the file to put in all of the stuff that Beth needs to do. So I go into the program files, Windows Server PowerShell modules folder. I then make a directory called DNSOps. I go into DNSOps. I create a new module manifest called dnsops.psd1. I create a new directory, subdirectory called role capabilities. I go into the role capabilities, and then I create a new role capabilities file called dnsops called PSRC or PowerShell role capability. And then I open ISE so that I can edit that. You can see how wonderful it is to have someone do the typing for you, or at least I did the typing for myself yesterday. I just stored it into the computer. So I do that. This opens Windows PowerShell ISE. So what I do once I've done that is I want to specify which commandlets are going to be visible. So those of you that know PowerShell know that there's commandlets and there's functions. So most of the DNS stuff is actually under functions, but I want to give the ability to restart this DNS service to Beth. So what I'll do is I'll come over here and I'll go down here until I get to visible commandlets. So I see visible commandlets, and under visible commandlets, what I am going to do is I'm going to give her the ability to use restart service, but only the DNS service. So visible commandlets equals name restart service, parameters, the name of the service, and the valid value for that will be DNS. Okay, so we've given her the ability to restart the DNS service. Then what we do is we come down to functions. Now, all of the DNS functions that we want to give her are add DNS server resource records, so she can add a record, clear the DNS server cache, view the resource records in a particular zone, and remove. So she can add and remove resource records and sort of verify that she's done that. So we go through, we go visible functions equals add DNS server resource record, clear DNS server cache, get DNS server resource record, and then remove DNS server resource records. You see here, I haven't put values and parameters in. I'm giving her a lot of freedom. She can use those commandlets how she wants. But if I wanted, I could lock that down to a specific zone. The final one I want to give her is the ability to show who she is. And this is going to be important when I'm actually showing you that she's using a virtual account. So I go in and I do that, and I've got visible external commands equals C column backslash Windows system32 whoami.exe. So what that means is that you can have scripts that you're allowing someone to run, executable files. You're not just limited to PowerShell when you're creating one of these roles. So I've done that. I click save. So I've created the role capability file. The next thing I need to do is I need to create the session file. So I come back down here and I execute the following command, which creates a new PowerShell session configuration file named dnsops.pssc. And that creates the basic file, creates that entire structure. So you see all of that stuff with the comments and so on. So I'm going to edit that. And that's created that file. So that command goes and creates the entire skeleton of the file. And then you just fill in the bits that you need to fill in. So what we've got here is I'm going to change the session type to restricted remote server, which means that it can only be used remotely. And what I'm also going to do is I'm going to come, if I wanted to configure transcripts so that everything was logged, I would basically decomment this line here. And here I've got the run as virtual account, and what I'm going to say is go and create a virtual account to run this as a local administrator. Do not use Beth's local credentials. Beth's credentials are only going to be used to validate that she can go and connect to the endpoint itself. Okay, and the last thing I do is I go down to the role definitions, and here what I do is I put in the role I created. So that is role definitions. We call it DNS ops, and we're limiting it to the ADATUM DNS ops group. So ADATUM DNS Ops can use the DNS Ops role capability file. So I save that. And then what I do is I basically set up and register the session. So what this does is that this basically puts this into play. Now, when you register a session, you do need to restart WinRM. And what this is doing is saying, okay, all of that information you've given me, let's load that up. So now we can look at, before we get that, I need to do a restart service WinRM and then get PS session configuration. And if I do that, this shows me all of the session configurations. And if I scroll back up here, I can see now that DNS Ops is actually a session configuration that's listed there. So what I'll do now is I'll come over to LUN Server 1 and I'll sign on here. So the first thing I'll do is I'll sign on as an administrator, and I'll just show you what a normal endpoint would look like. I'll just make this a bit bigger. So if I'm coming on here as an administrator, enter PS session, and this is just how you do a remote PowerShell session. Computer name will be LUNDC1 because that's the one I want to connect to. Get command. What I'm doing is seeing how many commands that administrator account has access to. And you can see that that's 2,259 by default. So that's what an unlocked down account looks like when it's doing that thing in PowerShell. And this is to show you how much you can really lock things down. This is who I'm locked on as. So what I'll do now is I'll exit the PS session and I'll sign out as the administrator. And what I'll do is I'll sign on as Beth. Just wait for Beth to sign on. Open up PowerShell, make that a bit bigger for you so you can actually see what's going on. Okay, so what we're going to do with Beth is we're going to have Beth remotely connect to the DNS Ops endpoint. So not just to the computer, but to the DNS Ops endpoint. She's then going to see which commands she can run. So let's do that. So enter PS session. Computer name is going to be LUNDC1. Endpoint is going to be DNS Ops. Now she's only able to connect to that if she's a member of the group that we set up for that. So we've made that connection. And what we can see here is that she's got access to only 13 commands. Instead of the 2,200, only 13. And she's actually logged on as a virtual account. So Beth's credentials are not logged onto this machine. Should this machine become compromised, no one's going to be able to run Mimikatz and pull Beth's credentials off the computer. And if I do a get command, these are the only commands that Beth has access to. If I do a get command minus module DNS server, you can see she's only got access to those four DNS server commands. So the last thing I can get her to do is I can get her to view the contents of the DNS zone file for adatum.com. So get DNS server resource record, zone name, adatum.com. And that shows you all of the records in that zone. What we're going to do is add a DNS server resource record called MelSVR1 for Melbourne Server 1. With the IP address, 172.16.0.101. And then if we go and view the contents of that zone again, we will see that that resource record has been created there. You can see that she can restart the DNS service as well, but let's try it with a different service that she doesn't have permissions to. And it comes up as invalid. So that is how just enough administration works. And as you can imagine, if you hook it in with privileged access management, you control the membership of that group. You should also think about then implementing jump servers and admin workstations. You lock it down at the firewall so someone can only make a remote connection using one of those PowerShell configuration files from specific IP addresses. So you're locking it down even further. You can deploy it using DSC or scripting. DSC is going to be a better option, as that way you're able to configure it for your entire organization very quickly in terms of locking it down. You do need to know exactly what tools people need to use to perform a task. The other problem is, of course, it requires you to do everything from the command line. That's Microsoft's new philosophy, is that we don't use GUI tools for a lot of administration. We should be using the command line. That's a very difficult thing to get to, and that's certainly not how a lot of us were brought up to do this, but it's very difficult at the moment to get this to work with other things. I suspect in future, though, you will automatically get tools that will basically allow you to issue a remote connection, and it'll show you all the stuff that you can do in a GUI should you want to set that up for someone who's on your help desk or someone in HR that might need to perform a particular task. It does require, at the moment, your administration team to use PowerShell, but you know all about PowerShell. Remember that complexity is the enemy of security. Configuring MIM 2016 at the moment is quite challenging, and configuring JIRA is challenging. I ran you through it. If you go to acca.ms/JIRA, they've got all of the documentation there. But this is the way that they want to go forward. They want to get people away from logging in with privileged accounts the whole time. Security is inconvenient, and you can imagine that that would be a bit inconvenient to do it all of that way, and that just-in-time administration is easier to implement than JIRA. Security in the long run does need to be commensurate with the value of your assets protected. So some of this sounds like really interesting, cool stuff, but it's really complicated, and if you're only protecting the local kindergarten's parent database, it's probably not worth going into put all of this security in. How, if you're running a bank or, you know, the secret New Zealand military that we all know in Australia that you have that could roll over us at a moment's notice, because it's really secret because we know you've got it, like, because no one would get rid of their Air Force, right? Unless they had, like, super rockets and drones and stuff that they weren't telling us about. Just make sure that what the effort you're putting in is commensurate with what you're protecting. If it's not, if you're not protecting anything worthwhile, then you know you don't need to put all of these great locks on it. There's no point putting like a $10,000 padlock on a $150 you know, statue of Optimus Prime. Anyway, has anybody got any Q&A? Otherwise, thank you very much for your attention. If you've got Q&A, just come up.